So I want to tell you today about some problem, some setting in which it is possible to tackle very high dimensional problems. Well, yes, Bellman coined the phrase the curse of dimensionality. He was talking about the way in which problems very rapidly grow much more difficult as the number of dimensions increases. Of course, Bellman was thinking perhaps of 15 or 20 dimensions, but today I want to talk in, well, hundreds, even thousands of dimensions. And in a way, it's really surprising that you can actually do problems with such, you can really tackle things in a concrete way when dimensions come very high. So I start with this example, this problem, which has been very important, very influential. This experiment carried out by Joe Traub at the University of Columbia and his student Paskov. They computed mortgage values of mortgage-backed obligations. So in the United States, as I understand it, mortgages run for 30 years and they can be repaid each month. The problem is to put a value on the holdings of a bank who hold a parcel of these things. And the complication is that that they can be repaid. And whether people do repay or not, of course, depends on how they feel, but it also depends in some way on the interest rate. So a model exists of this problem. It's a probabilistic model, of course, and it's a model in which you're calculating the expected value, and it's an expected value with 360 random variables in it. Because each month, you see, each month the interest rate can go up or down. Whether it will go up or down is a matter of probability. So the 360 random variables, or equivalently a 360 dimensional integral. Now, prior to this time, people had always done such calculations by some version of Monte Carlo method. They don't necessarily even think of integrals. But, of course, an expected value is an integral, and so Traub and Paskov decided to tackle this problem by using an explicit integration formula. And to everyone's amazement, I think, including their own, it actually worked rather well. Nobody believed it at first, but now I think people are completely convinced that you can do problems like this in some way. And so I want to tell you something of that story and of the things that have led from the experiment, because in a way it was just an experiment without any supporting theory. So I'm going to suppose that the problem has been already mapped to the unit cube, and if I have time at the end I will discuss an example where you can see how this is typically done. And so Traub and Paskov were using a version of quasi-Monte Carlo method, and of course that's something that I have to explain, so I won't assume that you know anything about these things. Now I begin by saying something about Monte Carlo. So Monte Carlo method, assuming we have an integral just already mapped to the unit cube in S dimensions, so it is just an equal weight formula. So what did we actually do with this? Anybody know?
Press.
Nothing happened. Maybe I'd turn it on.
No? Top right-hand button.
I leave it to you to experiment. Monte Carlo method just replaces the integral by an equal weight mean of the function values at points chosen randomly. So Monte Carlo has this flavor of gambling, of randomness. Oh, thank you. You can do it.
Press the white spot.
You press the white spot. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
The white spot is red light. Okay. If it had been a red spot, okay, it would have been light white.
And
white light.
Yeah, because it's easy to do. And one of the nice things about Monte Carlo, I should say while I'm on it, is that it does allow you, just from the spread of values, essentially, to estimate the error. And so that's the probabilistic estimate for the error in the root mean square sense is well known to be the square root of the variance of the function. This is the variance down here, and it's obviously something you can estimate, divided by the square root of the number of points. Monte Carlo does not suffer from the curse of dimensionality. It's really remarkable in that way, because it was 1 on square root of n, no matter how many dimensions you have. Now, quasi-Monte Carlo, it's the word now, it's now a standard word. I didn't invent it, and I don't have to apologize for it. It perhaps is a bad name, because perhaps it suggests Monte Carlo, but it's not based on randomness at all. It just looks the same, right? So the formula looks exactly the same. The difference is that the points are deterministic. So what you should think about is quasi-Monte Carlo was always trying to do better than Monte Carlo, and rather than to mimic Monte Carlo. And nowadays there are two ways in which people think about trying to choose points to do this. The low discrepancy points, Sobol was the first of these in about 1960, Henri Four, Niederreiter have done a lot of work on this. And I'm going to talk mainly about lattice rules, which is the things that I and my colleagues have been working on quite a lot in recent times, and both of them have substantial industries associated with them. Now, everybody has to agree that you cannot just do the obvious thing. You cannot just take any form of product. I'll just illustrate what happens here. It is sort of obvious, but if you were to take, just to do something very simple, I've just taken the product rectangle rule, equal weight, 5 by 5. Well, 5 to the S, capital N to the S points in general, capital N is here 5. And you see what happens if you take just the simplest possible function I can think of. It's a function of one variable only, x1, and it's just a linear function. What could be easier? Well, you can see what happens when you apply this rule to it, because all of it, since it's independent of x2, all of these points in this direction, in every direction except x1, just collapse. It's the same as, the error is the same as the 5-point rectangle rule, and that's clearly of order 1 on n. We can even work it out exactly what the error is, but it's of order 1 on capital N, and the problem is when you think about this in terms of little n, because it's little n to the 1 on s, there's the curse of dimensionality. And of course you could say, you can do better than the rectangle rule. Well, yes, you can use whatever you like, Gauss rule. But if you use 2 points in each dimension, then you have 2 to the s, 2 to the 360 points. And it's clearly infeasible. Any form of product just doesn't work. So that's out. You have to do something quite different. I'm not going to talk about sparse grids, the hyperbolic cross, and Smoliak's method. That also is a very interesting way of development, form of development, but I'm going to talk just about equal weight rules. That's quasi-Monte Carlo rules. So low discrepancy points. The low discrepancy points start from a famous inequality of Coxma and Lapka. These are number theorists. You need to understand the whole, this, but actually both branches of this subject come from number theory. And Lapka is a famous Austrian number theorist. It's a bound on the error for any function with any quasi-Monte Carlo method, and that bound is in the nice form for numerical things, that it separates into two factors. So the first factor depends on the points, not on the function. The second factor, which is something like the variation, depends on the function, but not on the points. So in one dimension, it's the variation. In higher dimensions, so you've got to worry about projections onto lower dimensional faces. It's the variation in the sense of Hardy and Krauser, but it doesn't really matter. You see, you now take the point of view. I haven't told you what this is, of course, this first factor. But we're now going to take the point of view that, well, the function is given. Can't do anything about that, but what I can do is about something about that first factor, which is the star discrepancy. So what is the star discrepancy? It's something defined sort of geometrically. It is the supremum over all red boxes. Well, this I'm thinking of as a red box. One corner is at the origin, and the other corner can be anywhere in the cube. here at point 6.5, and it defines a rectangle, a box, and what is here is the absolute value of the difference between the first thing is the fraction of the points that are in the box. So in this case it's 5 on 13, 5 out of the 13 points are in the box, minus the volume of the box, which in this case is 0.6 by 0.5. That's the fraction of the points that should be in the box. If we have a perfect distribution, the subject in which this occurs is the uniform distribution of sequences. This is a nice book by Kuiper and Niederreiter of that title, The Uniform Distribution of Sequences. And so you move the corner of the box somewhere else, in this case somewhere at the top, and you take the supremum and it's whatever it is. And of course it's important because of that Cox-Mellucca inequality. Well, so now the number theory says there exist low discrepancy sequences. A low discrepancy sequence is a point in which is an infinite sequence, actually a point in the s-dimensional cube for which the first n members satisfy this inequality. Constant, depending on dimension, times log n to the power s divided by n. So the first thing to say was fix s. And by the way, the number theorists and the numerical analysts traditionally always agreed on one thing, and that is that you fix the dimension. And you look at what happens as you change n. Now, if you ignore the log n, and how many times have we said log n can be ignored compared with powers of n? And so we ignore log n, and ignore the numerator, and so we just have 1 on n, which is clearly better than Monte Carlo, which is 1 on the square root of n. And it's optimal, you see, even in one dimension. You see, you can't do better than that, because that's the rectangle rule. It's only rectangle rule. So, and it's just, it's a fact that 1 on n seems pretty good in high dimensions, and in one dimension it's really terrible. But, yeah. But on the other hand, you can't ignore this log n to the power s, really, because the thing that I particularly don't like about it is that that bound keeps growing. As we increase n, it keeps growing until you are up to n approximately equal to e to the s. And so that's not a nice property of a bound. It gets worse. The harder you work, the worse the bound gets. Well, nobody likes that. So actually people never thought, and remember, this is a factor in our bound. As long as f has finite variation in the appropriate sense, then you get this 1 on n times log n to the power s. Well, you can't ignore the log n to the power s. So actually, people never thought that this was a high dimensional. It was never intended to be high dimensional. Multidimensional, not high dimensional. Niederreiter told me once that he always thought that maybe dimension of 15, but you could use this. And then later he thought, well, maybe 30. Nobody thought 360, and nobody thinks that now because the bound isn't good enough. So it provided a lot of motivation to try and to think about things differently. I thought I would show you what sobol points look like over here compared to random points. Well, pseudo-random points, because, whenever you have a random number generator, of course they're deterministic, but they are pseudo-random, they are pretending to be random. You notice the quasi is different. Quasi is not the same as pseudo. And this is random. They have the look of random points. They're really making a good effort to be random. There are big holes. Points fall where they will. So you can have big holes in the distribution and clusters, and that's natural. You look at these are much more uniformly distributed. And I can tell you what it is. What is the geometrical property that sobol used. So it's a geometrical property, of course, achieved algebraically. But the geometrical property is this. If you divide this cube, this square, up into, a half again, and so on, and you divide it up into 64 equal strips, there's one point in each strip. And similarly with 64 rows, and similarly if I divide it up into 8 one way and 8 the other way, one strip of each sensible rectangle of size 1 on 64 contains one point. It's a perfect net. Unfortunately, perfect nets don't exist in high dimensions. Indeed, you need the base, which is here 2, needs to be at least as high as the dimension to have a perfect net like that. But the design of nets is a big industry, and I must say that probably none of them are significantly better than the Sobol sequence, which is the space 2 one. So I won't say any more about that, just to mention some names again. There's a lot of work still going on. Actually, there's some beautiful work going on by some young guys. One, Joseph Dick is one of them, my colleague. But it hasn't been developed as much, so we should see. So now I'm going to turn to lattice rules, which I know, you know, more about. And it too comes out of the number theory camp in the late 1950s and early 60s. Karabov, Lufka, Karabov in Russia, Lufka in Europe, and a Chinese mathematician, Hua, and other people have worked on this. The classical theory was all about periodic functions. And you can imagine, you see how it goes. If you deal with periodic functions, you use Fourier series, or you use modified Fourier series. Your whole basis of these things is Fourier series, and you know, so it's here's a typical theorem from the Karabov. Let n be prime, then there exists a lattice rule. I haven't told you what a lattice rule is. There's the method of good lattice rules. There exists a good lattice rule such that the error goes down like 1 on n to some power, depending on the smoothness. So I want to tell you today about the use of these things for non-periodic functions. It's only fairly recently we realized that these things have a role for non-periodic functions. They're probably not the best things you can think of doing, but they are easy to devise and to program and to represent, even in very high dimensions. So the kind of lattice rules that we're talking about are quasi-Monte Carlo rules, so 1 on n, equal weight, but with a very specific construction for the points. The points are multiples, k running from 1 up to n, of z on n, where z is an integer vector. And so, down below is the shifted version of the same thing, which we will need just to shift. Oh, and what I must say is that these braces mean that we take the fractional part of each component so that it lies in the unit cube. So you can see with the numbers, you see why the number theorists were into this right from the start. So I give you an example of a very low dimensional lattice. This is two dimensional lattice, and it has 34 points, so n is there. Z is 121, the vector 121, and so you take multiples of 121 divided by 34, and this is what turns out, which is a nice looking pattern, well distributed in some sense. I should mention that this is rather special, that if you know your number theory, elementary number theory, you will recognize that 21 and 21 and 34 are consecutive Fibonacci numbers. So there is a Fibonacci construction. That works. But only in two dimensions is a construction known. There is no way of devising good lattices. There exist lots of bad lattices too. I didn't show you a bad one here. But, you know, a bad one, of course, has big gaps between the planes and all the points close together. And by the way, one way in which this is good is that if I go back to my original example of just a function which is just a function of x1 only, then all the one-dimensional projections are distinct. There are 34 different points. That's a good property, you see. And the Sobol points, the one-dimensional projections are good. Actually, this is the first important insight into how to make things work in high dimensions. If your functions are simple enough, you will do a good job if you have good one-dimensional projections. So.
Can I ask a question? However, those rules work for analytic functions? Is it better than 1 over n? Sure.
There's no advantage because it's just the rectangle rule.
Yeah, so if you had a periodic analytic function, then you could.
If you have periodic functions, this is really the classical theory, there exist very good lattice rules, and we can.
And then do you get 1 over n to some power?
1 over n to some power depending on the number of continuous derivatives. Well, if you have one continuous derivative, if you have no continuous derivatives, you get one on n squared. You know, it's like the trapezoidal rule and so on. And yeah, so all of that works. But so that leads me just to mention perhaps that you can make any non-periodic function periodic. But we've just been looking at this again, actually. You can force a change of variable that makes it periodic, you know, vanishes at the endpoints. So, and the trouble is it makes easy problems hard. It doesn't work in high dimensions. So the emphasis today is going to be on finding something that really works in high dimensions. Well, so if I want to do anything quantitative, I must tell you what is a criterion for what is our merit. How are we going to decide what is good? So that's the first thing. I'm just going to do a little bit of defining. And then in the development of this subject, it has always been, from the time of Korobov and Lapko on, that the main theorems are existence theorems. You know, that there exists good lattices. But very recently we found that we can actually not only prove existence, but we can actually do construction, which is interesting. And how can you do construction? Well, I say constructions are impossible. Well, we do constructions in the modern way via an algorithm, not a formula. There is no formula, but there is a good algorithm. That's what I want to tell you about, so I need to push on and do it. So, first of all, the function space setting. So, I should just tell you just about weights at the beginning. Henryk Wojnarowski and I started working on this about 10 years ago, and we were trying to understand these financial experiments. How can it be that they work in high dimensions? And we said, well, maybe it's because perhaps some of the problems are most difficult in the x1 direction and less difficult in the x2 direction and so on. But we thought to quantify that. Of course, that depends how you label it, and it depends on the problem. Actually, those mortgage-backed securities, in some sense, the early years of an investment are the most important of the decisions you make, most important. So, you can see there's some truth in this. It was just an idea. Actually, what I think is really interesting about this story that I'm telling today is that when we started, we thought we were doing something extremely abstract. We were looking at the problem of tractability and so on. We had no thought of construction. So what I think is interesting is that the character of the problem has changed. So we put in these weights, a sequence of weights, maybe I didn't even say that. Gamma 1, gamma 2, and I will show you where they go now. They decline. That's to quantify the changing importance of the different directions. And so the spaces we talk about are Hilbert spaces of non-periodic functions with norms. Well, to keep it simple, I just tell you first, in one dimension, one square integrable derivative, or this is H1, or so for the PDE people, and something else to make it a norm. These are very closely related to the traditional spaces used by Korobov and Lotka and so on. And so in two dimensions, so it looks more complicated. But look at this term, the last term, and in two dimensions, just that the mixed first derivative is square integrable. That's the key, and the rest just comes from the fact that we like to have a product structure. If f is a function of x1 times another function of x2, this norm is just a product of the two norms. Of course, as often in mathematics, we actually make all the choices of these things not just to make life difficult, we do them to make life easy. And so on, we go on up there, and I want to just make the point that all the spaces we work with, the reason we're able to do things, they're tensor product, first of all, spaces, reproducing kernel spaces, Hilbert spaces with a simple kernel. And for those of you who don't know the reproducing kernel stuff, very useful in all computational work, because the reproducing kernel Hilbert space is one in which point evaluation is a bounded linear functional. By the representation theorem, there exists a kernel, something, a function of two variables, x, y, that has this property. So it exists. in any. And of course, we always want to work in, numerical analysts want to work in spaces in which point evaluation makes sense. So it's the reproducing kernel property is this one. And in this case, this function, the kernel, this space I wrote down, it looked nasty, the norm, right? But the kernel is so simple. It's just a product from the tensor product structure of 1 plus his weight, gamma j, j's weight, times piecewise linear function of xj and yj. Could hardly be simpler. You can work with it. You can do anything you like with it, differentiate it. You can see that it's non-negative, and you have no problem working with it. So I'm just about to come to the existence question. Well, I get to give you the criterion. The criterion we always look at is the worst case error in this space. So the worst case error is just by definition the supremum, indeed the maximum, over all functions in the unit ball, supremum of the absolute value of the error, integral minus sum, for all functions in the unit ball, all functions with norm less than or equal to 1. And so I wanted to state the first theoretical result in the simplest form. And so what we were able to show, first of all, is that if the sum of the weights is finite, remember there are weights, we have a sequence of weights, so we need them to decay clearly so that the sum of the weights is finite. For instance, 1 on j squared or so will do. If the sum of the weights is finite, then there exists points, quasi-Monte Carlo points, such that the worst case error is less than or equal to constant, independent of dimension, divided by square root of n. And I'd like to just comment on that just quickly, and then I'll just indicate the nature of the proof, so you can see why it's an existence proof only. Well, if the result holds first for gamma as j is 1 on j squared, it does not hold for the classical case. And the constant we know explicitly, for instance, involves the sum of the weights, so we agree that sum is finite. The condition is necessary, so the classical case, this does not work. In the classical case, we know, we prove, the worst case error grows exponentially. If you take equal weights of any kind, I mean, independent of dimension, the worst case error grows exponentially. All classical settings, the problem is intractable. So we're pleased to, we're surprised perhaps to be able to find a necessary and sufficient condition just in terms of these weights. And finally, the proof is not in any way constructive. The proof goes, so I'd like to indicate the idea of the proof because it's very short. It's just on this one slide, and it's a typical kind of argument from the number theory literature. So let's think about the average of the worst case error. Well, it's the root mean square average. I call that M. That's overall, it's a bit hard to think about. If you think about the quasi-Monte Carlo method, you've got to choose N points. Well, we average over the position of all of those points. So it's a big, big, big integral. We can work that out, surprisingly enough. That's the result up there, and it's bounded. So I drop the second term, which is negative. I write a product as the exponential of the logs. And then I use log of 1 plus x is less than or equal to x, and so I get this upper bound. Well, I've almost finished. Now all we have to do is this wonderful principle that there always exists at least one choice that is as good as average. Fantastic principle, but you can see it's not very constructive. And in short, all the things that we prove are true for the average choice, and therefore there exists a good choice, but you don't know how to find it. The remarkable thing, and those of you with some experience of number theory will know this, that if you ever try to write down formulas and so on, it's so very hard to be as good as average. If you shut your eyes, you can be as good as average half the time, but if you try to be clever, you can never be as good as average because the truth, reality, the universe is more complicated than you can imagine. That's in number theory sense. So that's, if you are interested in just to see further into the mechanics, in every reproducing kernel Hilbert space, the worst case error can be written down and it can be therefore computed. I mean, that's really something, because most in numerical analysis you only have bounds, but this, you can estimate the worst case error. It's the double integral of the kernel minus the twice the sum times the integral plus the double sum of the kernel. It can be easily proved just from the properties of the reproducing kernel, and that's how you go, because clearly then this average thing is just an integral of all of this thing squared, or the integral of all of that. You integrate over the, so the job is you have to integrate over the kernel and so on. You can see how it can be done, how you can get to that very, very simple result that I stated, and it's a product because of the product structure and so on. Okay, so I'm almost up to the stage where I go to the next stage of construction. Maybe just for more insight. In the proof, we also obtain a lower bound. I mean, that's the other side, the necessary condition. How can you get a lower bound? Well, we get a lower bound, we do something extremely crude. We drop all the off-diagonal terms in the last sum because it's non-negative, so that clearly can only lower the bound. And that already grows exponentially fast, I mean, for the case of the classical case. So it gives a very, very simple estimate, actually. Well, but before I do that, the other thing wrong, remember, with what the result we have is that we only have Monte Carlo accuracy. Well, better result is possible. Due to Hikkanel and Wojnarowski in 1999, they also used a non-constructive proof of a different kind. Under a tighter condition on the weights, like for instance one on J cubed, there exist points, quasi-Monte Carlo points, such that the worst case error is less than a constant on n to the 1 minus delta, set of n to the half, 1 minus delta for arbitrary delta. And so that's what we like to think, apart from sort of logarithmic factor, that's sort of optimal in terms of rate. I mean, we like to think about it that way. And that's good, because now we're much the same position as the Coxmer-Lufka, except now we have a constant that does not depend on, again, the constant. The constant does not depend on dimension. It does depend on delta, but not on dimension. Okay, and now I'm almost up to construction. So the first hint that we might be able to do a construction of some kind came from this result. Wojnarowski and I proved, more or less, we proved this result more or less by accident, that under that same tighter condition on the weights, and if n is prime, then there exists a shifted lattice rule that has this error bound. Indeed, it even has this improved error bound. And shifted lattice rule is this thing, is why I showed this. And that's a better result, because you see, the previous result was there exists a quasi-Monte Carlo rule, but there are very few shifted lattice rules. Shifted lattice rule is defined just by Z and delta, right? So that now that suggests, maybe it suggests that you might be able to find Z and delta to do the job. So, well, I say we proved it by accident. I'd just like to just tell you about that, because we actually were studying something different. We were studying the periodic case. And don't worry, we'll do without that. You've done it once. We were studying the periodic case, and with that it's natural, well, we look at, it's a different kind of argument. But when we finished the paper, and the paper is called something about periodic case, we realized after we'd finished that you can then infer a result for the non-periodic case by another averaging argument. Just another averaging argument. So we tacked on another section in which we proved this result. Thank you very much. I try and keep it safe. And so we think, well, you can do something about construction, but still, it's still, you've got, well, even if you didn't worry about delta, which is a real vector of Z, but apart from that, Z is just integer, but the exponentially large number of them, I mean, as you, because in high dimensions. So, proof, well, I won't worry about it. So we're already up to construction. So we had a crazy idea about this, that we might be able, it might be possible to generate a lattice, sort of one component at a time. And it's a crazy idea because it is known to be impossible. And in the first paper we wrote on this, I was really naughty, because my good friend Harold Niederreiter had said in a paper, and we quoted this in the introduction of the paper, we quoted Niederreiter's statement that it's along these lines. I won't tell this in front of him, but that any attempt to construct a lattice by building on the existing lattice another component onto the existing lattice is doomed to failure. And I say, fortunately, we had forgotten that it was impossible, because that's what we did. It's exactly what we did, and it works. Because Niederreiter is right, too, I mean, you know, in some sense. But here's thinking in the classical context. In the classical context, it's too hard anyhow. Anything you do is doomed to failure, because the problem is intractable. So this is what we did. So we now call it component by component construction. It's a simple idea, it's a greedy algorithm, for those of you who know algorithms. And I tell you first this sort of basic idea, because I want to go past this, and so I just tell this briefly. But, you know, to shift a lattice just needs the knowledge of Z and delta. That's all you need. So we're just going to do it one component at a time. The first component, Z1 delta 1, second component, and so on. And the basic idea is that you would always, well, what have we got to work with? We always try to minimize the worst case error. It's just technically just a little bit difficult, because we've got two things to choose. So we actually minimize, we choose ZS. Wait, we know everything up to the S minus 1. We choose S from the possible range of numbers to minimize the average of this thing. This is also something we can write down as a formula. I won't write it, but you can compute it. And then we choose the shift from, indeed, you can just use the finite. Actually, this is interesting in numerical analysis. You use the principle that the rectangle rule always underestimates, or is it overestimates, for a convex function. So you go from the continuous to the discrete by a little bit of elementary numerical analysis. But we're able to prove. So here's something you can do. I mean, I'll comment on its deficiencies. But we have a theorem for it to back it up, I mean, to tell us that it's actually on the right track. If the sum of the weights is finite, well, that's a necessary condition, then with Z chosen by that, Z and delta chosen by the algorithm, this is the worst case error, less than a constant on square root of n, same constant as before. The proof, of course, is by induction. Naturally, you have to assume where you are. But then at each stage, we suppose we have a result, not exactly this result, slightly tighter result. You have that result at each stage, then you show that there exists a good choice for ZS and delta S by an averaging argument. The average has the property, so the best one must have the property. Always we use this same argument over and over. And I would just comment that the cost of doing all that is of order n cubed, not exponentially large, times S squared, but it is still too expensive. It goes just, you know, it's just too fast. So we in our calculations, we stopped at about 4,000 points and S equals 40. Of course, you could go further, but it becomes time-consuming. So we want to do better than that. The error bound we have is no better than Monte Carlo, which we don't like. The method, like every deterministic method, Gauss rules or anything else if it comes to that, unlike the Monte Carlo method, gives no idea of the actual error. Remember, Monte Carlo, you have a probabilistic error estimate. But if you do Gauss rule or something, you never know what the error is. And if you use any form of deterministic method, you don't know. And that suggests a way forward. Because we now think the best way forward, the best way to do things from several points of view, is to combine Monte Carlo and quasi-Monte Carlo. We now talk about randomly shifted lattice rules. And I think this is the technology we sort of believe in at the moment. Randomly shifted lattice rules is a joint work with Francis Kuo and Stephen Joe. And so that's a shifted lattice rule. But the difference now is that whereas Z is fixed, delta is now chosen randomly. This gives us, in fact, an unbiased estimate of the integral, which is good because we can use Monte Carlo-like ideas to estimate the result and to estimate the error. So what you do is you do it, excuse me, you do it Q times, 10 times. We like 10 times. Repeat it with 10 random shifts. Take the mean, and that's your estimate. But you can also estimate the error in a straightforward way. I've written it down below. So the algorithm. So how does it look? Well, first of all, we don't have to find the shift. This is wonderful. We had two things to find before. Now we're going to just choose a table of random numbers, a computer algorithm, a pseudo random number generator. So at each stage, we don't have to worry about that. We minimize the worst case error averaged over shifts, which I have just written down, defined down here. It turns out that that's, remember, we have a formula for the worst case error, but you can do the root mean square worst case error is even easier to compute as it happens. That's cheaper to compute, cheaper to do. And this then is the entire algorithm for the CBC algorithm that you can run, as far as you like. I'll comment on the cost in a moment. Start with, so all we have to do is to choose the components in our lattice rule. Remember, we choose the shift at random. And so we assume that we know Z2 up to Z1, Z2 up to S minus 1. And then we choose the ZS from this range. So it's just a discrete search to minimize this root mean square error squared, which is given explicitly here. I've just written it down just so you can see it is computable. B2 is the Bernoulli polynomial of degree 2. And the cost is cheap, and we have, again, we could prove the same theorem that if Z1 and Z2 are chosen by this algorithm, then we have worst case error less than a constant on square root of n. So in other words, we have a construction which is absolutely secure theoretical foundation, provided your functions lie in this space. And at the same constant as before, and the proof is again by induction. Now, I wonder, this is not the end of the theoretical story, but if you're doing your numerical analysis, as I think we are doing, you have the advantage always you can look at numbers to see whether they work out as you think they will. And there's something interesting about this table of numbers. So this is just a numerical example for 1 on j squared. Remember that sum of those is finite, so the worst case error should not grow with dimension. So, first of all, for 2003 points, that's the prime number, I hope. And 2003 points, you go down from S from 1 to 100 with some big gaps in the table. And so it's an iterative, remember, greedy algorithm. We take the first component to be 1. Doesn't really matter what the first component is, but it's all equivalent because N is prime number arguments. And then you find the next one to minimize the worst case error, root mean square worst case error. So that's it. That's worst case error, that's Z. And you just go on working down the table. Table's just constructed one line column at a time until you get to the end. Now, what I think is interesting, if you look at this column here compared to this one, so this is 32,000 points, approximately. So that's approximately 16 times as many points. So if it is Monte Carlo accuracy, the error should go down by a factor of 1 on 4. But you can see, if you look at these last two entries here, that the error has gone down by a factor of more than 10. So it's clear that we are missing something. There's something here that we haven't yet found. The rate of convergence is better than order 1 on square root of n. And both Poznikowski and I tried very hard to find a better result, and we came to the view separately that it was not possible to find a better result without changing the nature of our. When you prove something by induction, you never know if you have the right hypothesis. You know, you can always prove something with a different hypothesis. You just change it around a bit after the event, you know. So we decided it was impossible, but we didn't tell Frances Kuo that it was impossible, and so she proved it, which in her thesis, which is a very nice piece of work, and we were very impressed, and she won the inaugural Information-Based Complexity Young Researcher Award for this work. That if n is primed and z1 and zs chosen by this algorithm, provided the weight satisfied this condition, which we think is necessary, then the root mean square error is less than constant on n to the 1 minus delta for arbitrary delta. So as close as you like to 1 on n, essentially optimal. So now we have, at this point, you see we actually have a construction which works, which you can run. It's cheaper. I should talk about the costs. And it has guaranteed error of order, optimal order of error for the worst case error. But it turns out that you can do much better. So Nguyen's, our friends in Belgium, so these are computer scientists at the University of Leuven. Ronald Cools is well known in the field, Dirk Nguyen's is his student. And they showed that the algorithm can be implemented not in a cost of order n squared, as we had it, but in a cost of order n log n. And that makes a remarkable difference, because it means that instead of running out when you're in a few thousands or tens of thousands or what have you, you can run this now as far as you like. You can run it at s in the thousands and n in the millions. And I'd just like to tell you how it goes. What is the secret that they pulled apart what it is we're doing. In that algorithm, we have to compute this quantity, the worst case d squared, and we need to do it for all values of ZS. So it's the first term that doesn't matter. In the second term, it's a sum and a product. But what I've done is to separate out the last factor in the product, the S one, because everything else is known. All of this is known, and this part, we have to keep changing. Well, the red thing there, that's what is taking all the time. And Nguyen's, apparently, he likes to look at pictures. So on the left side of this picture is his picture of the matrix that you have to... It's matrix times a vector. And that matrix, as you can see by the color code, essentially every row has the same elements in it. And every column has the same elements in it. So if you can do and the reason for that is because it's B2 times the fractional part of IZ on N, and they're all 1 on N, 2 on N, up to N minus 1 on N in some order. That's the same elements in each row and column. And so if you're clever enough to make a proper and appropriate permutation of the rows and columns, you convert it into a circulant matrix. This is a circulant matrix, with the same information. And as every good computer scientist knows, circulant matrix times a vector can be done by FFT, fast Fourier transform. So I like to think about this. This is a really nice example of collaboration in research. It's something we would never have done because, frankly, we think like mathematicians in a traditional way, you know, we don't think like computer scientists. And I'm getting near the end of the story. But okay, so now there's a lot of other things to talk about, I suppose. The big question for applications, how should you choose the weights? Actually, we now think about weights in a different way. There have been different models, not just these are product weights, as we call them. But I don't want to go into that. I think we've taken some false trails. The big question remains, in some sense, how do you choose the parameters that go into all of this? And I'm not going to talk about that specifically, but I think I would just try to tell you about one problem, one application, which is very much the prototype application that we have worked on, which is problems coming from finance. So this is not the mortgage-backed obligation problem, it's the problem of option pricing. A typical one asset problem. It has this look. Please don't worry about the details of all this. This is an expected value with the Gaussian distribution, e to the minus x squared. Of course, there's some covariance matrix in here, the inverse of it. And if you are taking, if it's something that happens in time, and if it's following Brownian motion, or geometric Brownian motion, then this is the form of the covariance matrix, minimum of Ti, Tj. If you don't know this sort of stuff, it doesn't matter. But you see, we have an integral to work out in which this G depends on how you define the option thing. And so it's a high-dimensional expected value, and first step in doing that. So actually, this hints also at the fact that how you prepare the problem is actually very important in applications. So what you do is to factorize, everybody does this, factorize C in some way like this, because then with the change of variable you can diagonalize, you get rid of the C. So, but I should say it's not unique. There's a standard way of doing this, the standard formulation of the Brownian motion, which is just in terms of one thing after another, that corresponds to the which way, which form? One factorization. I don't want to go into the details, but there is more than one way to do this. There's the Brownian bridge, there's the PCA, and there's the standard formulation. They all correspond to different choices. Either, anyhow, you finish up with this, with a new variable, x is az. We've still got an integral over whole space, so this was about the trick about how do you go to the unit cube. Well, once we've got this variable separated, as we've done up here, with each component, we now take new variable to be the cumulative normal probability distribution, which runs from cumulative normal integral. Is that the right word? Runs from 0 to 1. It's the integral of the Gaussian distribution, normal distribution, from minus infinity up to x goes from 0 to 1. So now our new variables go from 0 to 1. The Jacobian of the transformation makes this now disappear. And so now you have g of a of phi to the minus 1. Phi is the cumulative normal probability integral, and this is to be understood component-wise, point-wise. And so now you have an integral, lives on the unit cube. Now we apply our quasi Monte Carlo rule, a lattice rule, or low discrepancy points if we want to use Sobol. And so it's clearly something that you can do. You have to work out all those phi to the minus ones, but that's just technical. And sometimes it makes sense to choose the matrix A by finding the eigenvalues, doing a full eigenvalue, eigenvector decomposition. And it's called principal components analysis. And we now know that how you should choose the matrix depends on what the option is. So it's not something I want to talk about, but for an Asian option. An Asian option is one in which the value depends on the mean of all the stock prices at the different times. Not the largest or the smallest, but the mean of them at time one, time two, time three. So that's an arithmetic Asian option. And for such things, PCA is good. And now the importance of the variables, it goes back to this original assumption that Wojnarowski and I had, that now it actually works. Because if the largest eigenvalue is the most important, and the next one is less important, and so on. And so it makes sense to talk about declining weights, something like this, with some constant. And I just want to show you how it actually works. So on the left is Monte Carlo, on the left on the error, and on the right is the error of Monte Carlo, and it is for n number of sample going from 2 to the 12th, which I suppose is about 4,000, is it? About 4,000 up to 16,000, and it's typical Monte Carlo behavior. You know, things do eventually settle down, they wander all over the place, there's nothing systematic, and the error is like this, and it's 1 on square root of n. You're not very fast, because when you're waiting for the error to get down, and it goes up again as it happened. This is a straight, some quasi Monte Carlo. I think this is a lattice rule, I'm not sure, Sobol. It settles down faster, it's better. But it's not dramatically better in looking at the error here. But if we combine everything we know, if we first make the right transformation, there's no package that will ever do high-dimensional integrals. It all depends on how it's set up. So here we combine everything in the green and do everything properly, and you can see it settles down fantastically quickly. So this is a problem then you see. Oh, and I didn't say the number of dimensions. I think this is 64 just as an example. 64 time steps, 4,000, 16,000 samples, and you can see, when you look at the error here, it's a very satisfactory picture of the error. So that's an actual genuine example. And I mentioned that then we have a project now with Macquarie Bank in Australia, which is an internationally aggressive merchant bank. It has large infrastructure holdings. It owns Rome Airport. It unsuccessfully bid for the London Stock Exchange recently. It's unsuccessfully bid for Qantas, actually, along with a few other people. But anyhow, in some small corner of the quantitative division, we have a project with them, and they gave us and they are interested in selling exotic financial products, and they would like to value them more quickly. I mean, that's where the imperative comes for them. They currently use Monte Carlo.
Of course, any firm owning the Rome Airport should be using mostly delay differential equations.
Yes, should I own the Monte Carlo Airport? And so a project that they gave to us to see if, you know, they wanted to test and see if we could do anything. And so it's a problem actually with 9,000 dimensions. And, you know, we can, and 9,000 dimensions arises very easily, actually. So I'll tell you how this comes about. So they have a problem. Their problem involves the behavior of five stocks, this product. It's an investment product for crazy people who like to gamble. And the value of this product depends on the behavior of those five stocks. And if that any of those prices, stock prices, reaches some barrier, special one for each one, then it's, boom, sorry, you lose that part of your holdings altogether. On the other hand, you get big rewards if they all stay above. So you have to sample it every day. There are five stocks held for 5 years. You sample it every day, and that gives you 9,000 dimensions. Actually, they want 80 stocks. The true product has 80 stocks. So this is just a toy problem. But anyhow, toy or not, I mean, this is, you know, I don't know whether we can really do the whole problem, by the way. You know, we have my ideas. We're working with Mike Giles, actually, at Oxford now, and his multi-level ideas, somehow we think this is also very helpful. So this calculation, it doesn't use a prime number of points. It extends, they have to extend the theory and the practice to work with embedded sequences of rules in which n runs from a power of 2. This is not a prime, but it has the virtue then that you can just double the number of points. And actually you can rearrange them, which is after all what Sobol does, to go for any number of points by filling in between in an appropriate way. And it's extensible in therefore in dimension, and it runs from 2 to the 10th is about 1,000, and 2 to the 20th is about 1,000,000, which is a good number of samples. And this is really quite a product. There are many open questions, one I particularly wanted to comment on the first. When is this model of function space setting appropriate? Well, let me tell you that it's not appropriate for the finance problems for which we have been using it. So whenever you deal with practical things, maybe always at some point you have to compromise, you have to give up your strict purity. Finance problems, they tend to have this maximum, the payoff, the g of x in there. It's an exponential of something, but it involves a maximum of this of something and zero, because you lose interest once the value reaches zero. So you don't exercise your right to the product once it reaches zero. So you have this kind of thing there, you see, just meeting of two planes. That has a derivative, a first derivative, but the trouble is that you can't then differentiate with respect to the next variable. So it doesn't have mixed first derivatives. So it doesn't fit, and that's a real problem, and that's it's a problem which we understand a little bit, but not too well. And how should you compute the weights? And how should you transform in general from RS to the unit cube? I should say we're also doing some problems with statisticians, which are a lot harder than the finance problems. 20, 200 dimensions. To really need to do very good transformations with Monte Carlo, with quasi-Monte Carlo, both ways you need to do good transformations. In the Monte Carlo case, they talk about important sampling. Well, important sampling means making a good transformation so that the final integral is nearly flat. Ideal in Monte Carlo is to reduce the variance by making the integrals nearly flat. You know? So that's the way of thinking about it, and for us the same. And we wrote an article on this for the December 2005 notices of the American Mathematical Society, and I recommend that as a good sort of introduction to the subject. We took a lot of trouble to try and write it in a way that could be understood. And the cover art for that issue is based on these graphics of Dirk Nguyen's. And so this is my finishing point. It's like what I showed you, but this is for powers of two rather than for prime. And now the whole argument is much more complicated. Truth to tell, I can't explain it. It is a beautiful piece of graphical work, and you'll see all those fine lines there, these threads at the end, tell you about the ways in which the permutations and so on are done. It's a beautiful piece of work. Well, so with that piece of art, I've finished. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions? Well, I have a question, sort of double-edged. Because there are all these results, some of them going back to the 70s, some of them from the last few years, about funny things happening in high dimensions. And sort of, at least on the face of it, it sounds like if some of these facts should be very conducive to computing in a very large number of dimensions, these sort of methods, and others should be very non-conducive. Yeah. One is the measure concentration phenomenon, essentially that functions in a very large number of dimensions are virtually flat, except for very, very small domains, exponentially small domains, but they are not flat. And of course, if you have a function that is flat, you can evaluate its integral, and the higher the dimension, the flatter it is. So one should be able somehow to exploit it, even in the choice of quasi-lattice points and so on. On the other hand, there are all these recent results of Donohoe and Tanner and others about sampling random points on high-dimensional polyhedra, and that these samples collapse into low-dimensional subspaces.
Yeah.
So somehow, if you are sampling in very high-dimensional space, even if you say sampling with Monte Carlo, you should not, probably will not be covering all of it. There will be sort of lumps of points.
Was that a question?
Yeah, so, how all this? No, because we are all used to Monte Carlo in 5, 10 dimensions, physicists and so on, but in 1,000 dimensions, I wonder how this enters into...
Do you have an answer?
No, I want to rephrase the question in a different context as a physicist. If you take the sphere in n dimensions, the unit ball in n dimensions, then the higher the dimension goes, the closer the volume, the most of the volume is concentrated near the surface, and that I think that's your question.
For
the unit sphere, I don't know.
That's right.
A unit box, I don't know how it works, but that must be a phenomenon that you have to take into account, is my impression.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's very interesting. I like the bit that if you think about the sphere in high dimensions, most of the measure is concentrated, you know, arbitrarily close to the equator, but it's the it's the same thing. Yes. Yes, you've raised this question before, and I think it's a very interesting one. I mean, there are all sorts of the cube is a little bit strange because it's differently scaled. We had Marcus Hegland and I have had conversations about this. It is differently scaled. I mean, you think, of course, the unit cube, it always has volume one, and it seems completely straightforward. But remember that the principal diagonal is growing as the square root of the dimension. So, and I mean, this is a reflection of the fact that this distance between points is getting larger and larger. There's more and more empty space. Any notion you have... So here's something. So we've thought about this in other contexts. How can you be sure that there is one point in the center half between a quarter and three quarters in each dimension? Well, the thing about it is sort of obvious that you better put a point in the middle and make sure there's one there because of Otherwise, the probability becomes vanishingly small, that it's exponentially small, the size of that box. So if you choose them at random or just leave it to the working of the algorithm, it won't happen. You'll never have a point there. But somehow, in the way that we do it, which I've told you really, you know, the spirit of all of the arguments we use, we never have to worry about the geometry somehow. It's fortunate. I mean, we are using entirely computational and analytical tools to obtain results, and constructions are just recursive algorithms. Because if we did have to worry about geometry, the geometry is a real, you know, cow. I mean, the way we used to do lattice rules, devise ones with good geometry in some sense, and it's hard to find tools to actually do it. I mean, you know, the concentration is a phenomenon, but it's not an algorithm. Somehow, on the other hand, we are able to devise algorithms without ever having to actually sort of worry about how close the points are to each other, or what is there, how many are in the corners. They're nearly all in the corners now, so they're nearly all at the surface for the reasons you said. How many are inside the bounding, the inscribed sphere, a ball? None of them. I mean, you know, but we don't care about all those things. Somehow it doesn't matter. And the user doesn't have to care, because in the end we could just tell you, you know, a good universal Z, I mean, if we are really optimistic. That's our holy grail, by the way, is to find a good lattice rule that works, you know, most of the time, and put it on the web, you know, up to any number of dimensions, and you just cut it off where you want. So I don't know if that's an answer. Somehow we are able to bypass this question.
Well, you know, essentially I didn't ask whether geometry is a problem, but whether you can exploit geometry.
Yeah. Well, we don't. We don't know how to, and I'm glad about that, actually. Because this is still only sort of, they're asymptotic ideas, but they're hard to make into a quantitative tool.
Mm.
Yeah, you could ask the question differently. I mean, you could ask, you have now a solution. I mean, what does it, these points that you get, what is the geometry of these points? I mean, there must be some sort of concentration of these points, maybe along the diagonal or so, where, I mean, yeah?
Yeah, of course, if we talk about lattices, of course, the geometry is, in fact, extremely simple. You only need to describe the unit cell, but it's still hard to picture, isn't it, in high dimension.
Yeah, I think that none of us have the intuition to really think about dimension n greater than geometry. Yeah. I don't have any further questions. Well, thank you again for a nice sermon.